Welcome to Polycast, a civilization podcast focused on game strategy.
Dan Q.
Makalua.
The Mian Team.
QNL.
With guest co-hosts.
K-Man Candy.
Sula.
Kelly or Michael, is one of you willing to do the introduction to the show?
I had to do it last week.
So translation, you want to continue, okay.
Excellent.
What's this have to do it, man? What kind of thing is that?
Michael, would you be willing to do the introduction to the show?
I will, but I have no idea what you say in the introduction. I've never listened to Polycast.
Yes.
That's okay, neither do we.
That's the favorite thing to hear.
I just don't know everybody's names. I have everybody's username. I don't know everyone's actual name.
I can even take that out. Don't do it, I don't know.
Yeah.
I'll even type in your name, Michael, in case you forget it. I know how that happens.
And the new pronunciation for Dan Q is Dank.
Don't poison our first time.
if we're trying to confuse our listeners and annoy Dan a little bit, we should definitely refer to him as Dank.
And know that it's not K-Mad Candy, it's actually Kitty Cat.
Well, I kind of forgot the D there, too. It's not K-Mad Canny, no, definitely not.
Oh, yes! And it's not the Mian Team, it's Trollolol.
Exactly.
Sounds properly pronounced now.
Come on now, I am an upstanding player who puts the utmost effort into achieving the victory condition with my team. Assuming I have a team.
And Mackie's actually not Mackie, it's Bow Chicka Bow Wow.
I think you need to pronounce that with as much singing as possible.
Why are you encouraging him? Why?
Sing the introduction. Yes, or the closing.
No, just her name. Just her name.
Oh, I see. Oh, okay. Are you willing to do the closing to the show, though, Kelly?
I suppose. How do you say Michael's username? I always said Sula in my head. Was that wrong?
Well, technically it's Sula because it's a Latin pronunciation, but it really doesn't bother me one way or the other. It's fine either way.
Okay.
It's not that big a deal.
If I'm going with Dank, Kelly is Kitty Cat, Phil is Trollolo, and Bow Wow. We got to come up with something for Sula here.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is the 129th edition of Polycast. My name is Michael Sirocco, and I go by the username Sula in the Civilization community. With me here today are Dan Quick, who goes by Dan Q, with Kelly, who goes by K-Mad Candy, and with Philip Bello, who goes by the Mian Team.
Starting with, do people finally like Civ 5 now? And another related thread recently, is it worth playing now?
Okay, well, as far as that goes, some of you may know that I am a longtime Civilization player, and I have been a large critic of Civilization 5 in the past. I'm pretty well known for writing a number of articles about Civ 5, talking about a number of the balancing issues, a number of the gameplay issues that deal with Civ 5. Now, I just want to get one thing out of the way first, because I know that people will bring this up. I have not actually played Civ 5 since December of last year, so that I haven't actually played Civ 5 in 9 months, and you don't need to flame Polycast for bringing that up and in terms of the discussions. So I just want to bring that up to begin with, but I have been following along with the discussions that have been going on the forums. I think I have a pretty good idea of what's been going on with Civ 5. As far as I'm concerned, I don't think that Civ 5 has really changed all that much. So this is a hot topic on the forums. Do people like Civ 5 now? Has the game actually improved? I think that there have been some improvements, definitely speaking, but I think a lot of the improvements have been more things on the surface level, that is, things that were easily correctable, minor things like dealing with social policies, dealing with rebalancing unit stats, things like that. But I would say that a lot of the core balancing issues with Civ 5, and perhaps we'll get into them as we go through here on Polycast, I would say that a lot of the core issues that were problems with the game haven't been addressed in patches. Perhaps they'll be addressed by modding later on, but as far as the base game itself, they haven't really been dealt with in a lot of different ways. So as far as I'm concerned, I think that if you like Civ 5 and enjoy playing the game, that's great. That's awesome. If you enjoy the game, that's great. But in terms of people who are still holding out hope that there are going to be sort of major changes with expansions, with more patches down the line, I'm not sure that we're going to be seeing that as far as Civ 5 is concerned. So that's sort of my take on that issue.
Well, some of our gripes overlapped. I mean, I obviously read his article as well. I even referenced it earlier on the show, and closer to the release time of Civ 5 when we were discussing this originally. But I think a lot of the changes they made were they're a step in the right direction when it comes to the balance of the game itself. But a lot of the complaints I have about the game are still there. And for me, there's some things that grate me more than other players because I play quickly, and that is reflected on my frustrations with the turn time, with the user interface, with commands not necessarily going through every time. But I do still agree that the board can get pretty crowded on the higher difficulties as well. I'd like to have just seen more hexes. I don't know. But it's definitely different. It's not the same as the other Civilization games. It doesn't make it bad. And that's a good point about the mods. I have not historically played a lot of mods outside of like Hall of Fame mod, but that's something that could potentially make Civ 5 fun. So I'll be checking them out.
I use this as an opportunity to plug our sibling show, Modcast, which is coming up monthly between July and December of this year. It's back up and running, and primary focus actually on Civ 5 right now. I would say for myself, one of the reasons that I thought we should discuss this topic, in addition to the fact that it's very topical right now in the forums, is because we are coming up on the one-year release for Civilization 5. I believe it was about the 21st of December in North America, and then 21st of September. Rather, 21st of September, and then 24th of September last year for the rest of the world. And we've seen a number of significant patches in that time. And we have had some one step forward and two steps back in some considerations. We've had some one step forward in other areas, and in other areas we have had no movement at all. I'm not going to comment on any issue specifically, in part because both Sula and the Mian team have noted some of that and the fact that we've discussed it extensively. I think my biggest frustration with regards to the game, generally speaking, is, and I've talked about this before, is when a patch is released, two things. One, a patch is often significant and has some significant gameplay implications that require you to adjust your play. And my second major concern has been that those patches are applied right away. And we've also talked about that before. But for someone who had been playing the game 4 or 5 months ago and stopped and would like to get back into it, a lot of it is you know, trying to start the game over again. And I will say also that I think the single-player game is better than the multiplayer experience right now. And it really doesn't matter, strictly speaking, on whether or not your computer is at minimum specifications or not. There's issues continuing with the network code, and Fractus and 2K have publicly stated that that is an upcoming focus, and I'm glad to see that, although I think a lot of people would say that they're really only starting to look at it now. It might have been nicer for some more gradual approaches to addressing it until, you know, pretty well pushing the one-year anniversary, because a lot of people have moved away from that. And I think that if the multiplayer experience had been comparable to single player as it is now, people would still be concerned about the AI, but they wouldn't be concerned about the AI so much that it's, okay, we have to stop playing the game because I'm too frustrated with the AI in the single player and cannot move into the multiplayer because of issues with it.
Have you guys played a lot of online multiplayer for Civilization in the past? I'm not sure what everyone's experience is with that.
I've done a decent amount in Civ 4 and almost nothing with Civ 5.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there were a lot of issues with Civ 5 multiplayer. I believe the core problem there is that when they were doing the design for Civ 5, that they were conceptualizing it only as a single-player game, and then they tried to add on multiplayer sort of halfway through the design process or towards the end of the design process. It's very obvious in terms of how a lot of these civilization traits and abilities are implemented. For example, just to pull one out, the way that Greece's unique ability is gains more influence with city-states. I mean, that doesn't really make sense in a multiplayer context. If you were designing the game from a multiplayer perspective to begin with, that wouldn't be their ability. So they kind of tried to put multiplayer in sort of halfway through the design process, and it really shows. And then put that together with the fact that Civ 5 was very obviously released before it was ready, and you're up with a lot of really sloppy code. Things like the fact that you can't even ping the map in Civ 5 multiplayer, which is just kind of silly because every online game ever allows you to ping the map. You can't see what your teammates are researching when you're playing on a team. The fact that the game crashes when it's almost unplayable with more than four people. When I know that back in 2005, we were running 5-on-5 in Civ 4, and so it seems a little bit silly that a game that's 5 years newer can only run four players when we could run, you know, 10, 12, 14 players online with Civ 4, which is not to say that Civ 4's online multiplayer was great. It had its issues as well. And in particular, connecting in the staging room was really awful a lot of the time. But it just reflects sort of a sloppy design process in terms of the multiplayer, which is a shame because, as we've mentioned, a lot of the AI issues are one of the big problems with Civ 5. So you would think, oh, you know what? Maybe if you could go online and play multiplayer, that would really solve a lot of the problems. But the networking code, a lot of the issues with running through Steam, things, we thought that the game would run much smoother through Steam, but as it turns out, it's just been kind of a disaster. So it's unfortunate that that's taking place. It would be nice if Firaxis fixes this, but since the game's been out for a year and there's been very, very minimal changes to multiplayer, I'm not holding my breath that all of a sudden things are going to get fixed in the upcoming future. But I guess we'll see. We'll have to wait and see. Perhaps they'll be able to manage things. Perhaps we'll see some changes. But it's a bit of a shame because if Civ 5 was designed for anything in mind, it should have been multiplayer. And it looks like that's one of those things that just kind of fell through the cracks.
As I recall, when Civilization IV was in development, it was the multiplayer got working first, and then the single-player game evolved once there was the multiplayer base there, and I think...
That's right, Dan. That's how it was done.
And you can balance a lot better with that. A lot better. Yeah, the Civ 5 has been frustrating for us as well. We have had some weekend games, and in the co-op sense, attempted on Civ 5, and it's like you said, anytime, in our case, it was over three people, we would tend to just get people dropping from the game. But the thing about single player and the AI, at least for me as it stands right now, is that the AI is kind of standing in no man's land between like a role-playing function and trying to act like a human player and attempting to win the game. And it's really not pleasing either side of the argument. Now, the game itself has been modeled such that permanent diplomacy is absolutely worthless from a diplomatic standpoint. There's no permanent alliances. There's no benefits to having a long-standing relationship with another civilization beyond whether it's convenient to your civ at the time for a long period of time. So for the AI to sandbox wouldn't make sense because it's basically not playing the same game as you are then. But at the same time, having the diplomatic models that we're seeing right now and just the irrational AI behavior can be a little frustrating. I would like to point out, though, that the Firaxis history is not so shiny, even going back into Civ 4. The last couple patches in Civ 4 really grated me, especially 3.19, when they nerfed Protective, and still didn't fix the issues, which plague me in multiplayer, since I prefer a blazing timer, where you can't select your units. You control-click to select a set of units in the stack. You shift-click to unselect a unit in your stack, so you don't attack with it, right? And it just does nothing. Or it'll select the whole stack when you're not pressing Alt. It's like, what's going on here? And when you're talking about simultaneous turns or simply a turn timer, issues like that can cause you to run out of time. Now, and on top of everything else with the Civ 5 multiplayer problems, certainly the community's taken a lot of damage from the simple fact that people can't play the game, among the other things like balance. God, Germany's UA, when you first started, too, that was really bad. They did address that, at least. But, yeah, well, the turn timer is no option to be fast.
Yeah, me and team brings up a nice point here about how the diplomacy system is set up in Civ 5. I'd like, since I have the chance to be a guest here on the show today, I'd like to be able to talk a little bit about that. But I always thought the design for Civ 5 was really interesting in regards to the diplomacy. I'm sure a lot of you who are listening also watched the interviews that were going on last year with the designers who talked about what they wanted to put into the game, how they wanted to design the diplomacy. And a lot of the thing that they kept saying ahead of time was they wanted to say, we want to make diplomacy mysterious, we want to make diplomacy unpredictable, and they did in fact achieve that goal. Diplomacy is very mysterious, and it's very hard to predict. But the problem is, yeah, and I agree with, I hear you laughing in the background, the problem is they went too far with it, and if you have diplomacy that's entirely unpredictable, where the AI civs are always willing to backstab you, then you end up with a system that doesn't really function very well. I think that the two biggest problems that I have with the diplomacy system is, number one, you can't ever really make friends. And that's a bit of a problem. You'd think that if you have a positive relationship with other AI empires, let's say that you're trading back and forth, let's say that you have gone to war together with other civs, you'd like to be able to build up some kind of a friendship with these civs. But the problem in Civ 5 is that they will always backstab you, always. When you get close to winning the game, they will always turn on you. And while that might make sense in some kind of a real politic, only one person can win, people in real life don't behave that way. I've played a lot of online games, I've played a lot of board games. Some people are willing to backstab, but not everybody is. So the system would benefit a lot more if there were certain leaders, like, I don't know, maybe Gandhi or friendly leaders who would be willing to work with you. And then you can have your psychopaths that are willing to stab you in the back. But the fact that they all are always willing to backstab you at all points in time, the fact that you can never really make friends, it's just not a realistic model of human relationships. It's like a computer trying to act like a human and failing. And then the other second problem with diplomacy is that nearly all of the important calculations are hidden under the hood. All of the information on what's really going on is not shown to the player. For instance, there's a lot of things about how war declarations work. Basically, if you declare war twice, I think it is, that you're considered a warmonger, but the human player is never told this anywhere in the game. How the AI behaves is all hidden in these XML tables that are posted on the forums, but they're never displayed anywhere in game. You take a huge penalty if you take the last city of a civ or if you conquer a city state. But again, this is never explained anywhere in the game. So all of this stuff that's hidden under the hood and should be available to players so that they can figure out what's going on, it's never displayed anywhere in the game. And yes, if you go online, if you go to Apolitan, if you go to Civ Fanatics or whatever, you can find out this information, but it should be available in game. Because a lot of the frustration that people have is the fact that they don't know what's going on and it's never explained to them anywhere in the game. And again, I think that that's a product of a rush design phase where a lot of this stuff that could have been put into the game just had to be compressed due to reasons of time. Anyway, I don't want to be the only one speaking here. I'm hoping that Kelly and Mackie can get a chance to jump in here at some point as well.
Yes, this conversation needs a little more estrogen.
I agree with you on that point. The stuff that's supposed to be random that we're not supposed to be able to figure out what's going on, then hide that stuff from us. But the stuff that is exactly according to a formula and is going to be the same way every time, if you do it the same way every time, why are you hiding that from us? If we can figure it out, then why do we have to learn the formulas ourselves? Why are you hiding it? I don't understand that as a principle.
I've always been against the opaque AI. Because ultimately, who does that punish? It punishes newer/casual players trying to learn the game, and they just
the
get
people that don't look it up.
And players, like most of us, we're going to go onto the forum and look at the XML or look at somebody's spreadsheet about the XML and know that, okay, if you deal the finishing blow on a civ, you're considered a huge warmonger. But if you take all the cities and leave one civ and let a city state kill it, you're not a warmonger. In fact,
which is really silly anyway. It doesn't really make a lot of sense, let's be honest.
No, it doesn't.
I will bring up what Majin has noted in the chat in response to recent discussion here on the show. Whining about the internal mechanics, not really learn, quote unquote. And I think we've already started to address some of that, which is the learning aspect for people like us who I think we're geeks. Right? You know, I mean, I know everything's relative, but we really like getting into the internal mechanics and or we also know how to get into the internal mechanics.
And there is a vast pool of casual or less geeky gamers that never push past that.
Well, I have people that get into the internal mechanics for me, and I go on the forums to find those people.
Yes. exactly.
I think that this is where a lot of the conflict over Civ 5 comes from, because I think that if you play the game just for sort of a relaxing state, you're not interested in sort of pushing the game to its boundaries. I think the game works very well for people who are not sort of demanding high-end users. I think that if you just want to relax, want to move the units around on the map, I think it's a fun game for that. The presentation of Civ 5 is pretty good on the whole. Graphically, it looks pretty good. There are some issues, but overall it looks pretty good, particularly if you're not diving into menus, if you're not diving into the cities. It's a much better looking the game. I think the sound is excellent in Civ 5. I think the music is very, very good. It's never something that I've wanted to criticize the game about, but it's when you're sort of one of the demanding high-end users, someone who's going to, you know, like we said, go on the forums, look up how things work, take the game apart, that's sort of where things start to fall apart, because when you play the game at the highest levels, there are certain very narrow paths to victory that demonstrably outproduce all of the other ones. And perhaps we'll be able to talk about these later on, but things involving the manipulation of research agreements and great scientists in particular, once you start abusing those things, the game really falls apart, because these game mechanics are not very well designed, to say the least. And of course, the AI can't keep up on higher difficulties either. All it can do is spam more units. And then that's where the very one unit per tile rules of the game start to work against the AI and causes all sorts of problems. But anyway, like I said, perhaps we'll get into that later. But I do think that for a lot of people, for probably the overwhelming majority of users, because most people do not play the game on Deity, Civ 5 probably works pretty well. And in a way, me being someone who likes to play the game on the highest difficulties, perhaps my criticisms aren't valid for a lot of these people, and I'm perfectly willing to accept that.
I would like to be able to play on the larger maps or in the later eras without having to resort to strategic view to make my turn times not be so stupid. It's the same thing with moving the units.
Yeah.
There's
a lag.
There's
a threat that came up on that.
Other than I wish MP would get touched up, that is my other big complaint. Because my computer is actually newer than Civ 5. It should not have this trouble.
Yeah, I've read stories of people with like quad cores having close to a minute turn times. Like, what's the game doing? And then you put it in strategic view, and it goes down to like 5 to 10 seconds for them, and you realize that the game is animating units off screen. Like, what are you doing? Come on! The deployment in Civ 5 is really interesting to me. It seems almost like they went the temporary deploy route on purpose. I'm not sure I agree with it, but they really made it so that there's no incentive. It's not just an AI question. There's no incentive to form long-term relationships in Civ 5 whatsoever. And the only thing that would keep you from attacking somebody to your own benefit is whether it's useful to you at the time or not. And that holds true in multiplayer as well. I would have really liked something at the design level to give both AIs and humans some kind of incentive to have a lasting friendship. That would have made the diplomatic side of things so much more deep.
Well, one of the things that they could have done would be just to put more incentives for trade in the game. There's very little trading that goes on in Civ 5, particularly compared to some of the previous games in the series. Just the fact that, I mean, in Civ 4, you have an incentive to be peaceful, because if you sign open borders deals with the other civs, then you get trade route income from the other civs. But there's nothing like that in Civ 5. Trade routes are just all you do is connect your capital to your cities, and boom, there's a trade route. So that removes one very big incentive to stay peaceful with the other civs. I mean, of course, there's also sort of just fewer trading options available. You can't trade techs in Civ 5, which there's nothing wrong with that. It's a valid design choice. But again, it does remove incentives to be peaceful with other civs if there's no need to be trading techs back and forth. Research agreements aren't really, I mean, they're somewhat similar, but one thing that Civ 5 has shown is that you don't need to be good friends with other civs to sign research agreements. They'll basically always sign them with you if you can come up with the money. There's also no map trading in Civ 5 either. So, I mean, again, there are still options, but mostly in Civ 5, you basically just take resources, you sell them for gold to the AI civs, particularly on the higher difficulties where they have more money hanging around. You just sell your resources for gold, and then you use the gold to sign research agreements starting in the mid-game. And it's almost more of like sort of a vending machine than really a model of diplomatic interaction. You're basically just, oh, get gold, then buy stuff with gold. And I mean, there's some finesse, there's some skill there. Managing research agreements actually takes a fair amount of skill, but it's the same thing in every game. It's not really changing. Once you figure out how to balance that medium It's like the medium beaker amount that you get per research agreement. Once you figure that out, it's not really going to be changing, and you can kind of do the same thing in each game. So it does remove a lot of the sort of higher level strategic stuff from the game. Where there certainly could be a more nuanced way of representing diplomatic interactions with other civs. There just needs to be more incentives to be peaceful, as the Mian team was saying. There's not really any incentive ever to make friends with anyone, which is kind of weird. You'd think that I should get something out of being friendly with another civ. I mean, keep in mind, too, diplomatic victory reworked in Civ 5. The other civs do not vote for you. So once again, you don't have to be friends with them. You can just go conquer them. They don't matter. It's the city-states, and you just buy them up for the diplomatic victory. But again, another thing that a little bit questionable from a design decision, just making it so you basically purchase your way to a diplomatic victory. Not sure that that was handled as well as it could have been.
They should have just called it something else, like they did in like Alpha Centauri, like cornering the world market or something.
Economic victory.
That's really what it is. You just outbid everybody and win diplomatic, whether or not they're trying to stop you, which is whatever.
Briefly back to the internal mechanics thing between, you know, the casual player and the person who is, you know, really involved like we are and wanting to know. I'm definitely not saying that if you want to learn the mechanics, you wouldn't then be better off because you learn a little more, but it's not only the lack of information that is given to the player on screen, but kind of what's already been touched upon, so, you know, I'm not going to keep harping on it necessarily, but what is said but is in fact not true in terms of, for example, an AI's particular disposition towards you. And for someone like me, who I consider myself a mid-level player, Civ 5, I'm on Emperor level, I would like to go higher. Like, I'm happy where I am, but I would like to go to a higher difficulty level, and I'm seeing what it is that I have to know or should know to improve the likelihood that I'm at least going to have a fighting chance to win. I don't expect every single time I play, even on Emperor, that I'm going to win, because I know that I can make stupid mistakes, and the AI could get freaking lucky. But at the same time, I want to feel like I have a chance, that there's a progression, that I'm actually learning something. And if we're saying you need to dig into the mechanics in order to be able to go from a casual to a moderate level player to a higher level player, that you have to do that beyond simply seeing what you see on the interface, what you see in the game, what you see on a replay, I think that is negatively hurting the desirability of people to pick up the game and for people to continue to play the game.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that it's interesting that so much of what goes into high-level play is essentially metagaming things. It's things that you wouldn't be aware of unless you were taking part in the Civ community. I actually think that a lot of people probably would have more fun if they weren't connected with the community, because they wouldn't be figuring out a lot of these things. Like I said, how to use research agreements, how to use great scientists. You can essentially jump your way through the tech tree late in the game using the combination of these two. After you hit about mid-Renaissance, if you are able to slingshot your way into Porcelain Tower and slingshot your way into rationalism, take the first point in rationalism, social tree policy, then you can really manipulate the game into basically giving you the whole tech tree almost for free. You never actually research any of these texts. You just get them all through great scientists and research agreements. It's a very interesting way to set up a game. The designers have been tinkering with the whole tech system a lot. They've done a lot of different things. In the initial release version, the techs were just too cheap, and you could just infinitely spam cities everywhere, and you would have so many beakers that you would just complete the tech tree by like turn 200 or something, and it wasn't particularly great. They've reworked it a bit, but they've tried, I think, two or three different implementations of research agreements. To me, it's one of the things that just probably should not be in the game, the whole research agreement thing. It's just the whole way that they work is very counterintuitive. They've changed it to the whole median thing. Basically, you can research some techs and get fewer beakers from the research agreement, or if you research other techs, you'll get more from a research agreement. And then there's the whole issue of the randomness of whether or not an AI will declare war and invalidate them. It's a very questionable game mechanic, and the ability to just slingshot your way through the tree, particularly if you have landed Porcelain Tower and Rationalism. And Porcelain Tower is pretty easy to get because you can use the free great person from Liberty Tree to just pick up an engineer and rush that. Anyway, if you're doing those things, you're just getting infinitely more beakers than the AI is getting from the research agreements, and it really causes the game to break down. Now, the challenge, of course, in high-level play is surviving to get to that point, because the AI will declare war on you over and over again in the beginning of the game. So a lot of the gameplay comes down to, will you get rushed and how quickly will you be rushed by the AI in the first 50 turns of the game? For me, that's one of the reasons why I have no incentive to come back to Civ 5. I know what people are doing. I know how the gameplay works. It doesn't sound like it's particularly fun to me when most of what's going on is whether or not the AI is going to rush you or how many AIs are going to rush you in the early game. Doesn't seem like a lot of fun to me. But I know that there are a lot of good players out there who are playing around with this and have come up with some really interesting stuff. I just think that the gameplay mechanics are really not there because you never, in the late game, you're not actually researching techs. It's one of the strangest research models I can remember in a game where your actual beaker count really doesn't matter once you get to the later portions of the game because you're not actually researching any of the techs, and it causes a whole lot of problems.
The next topic is on city growth, specifically how to get a city to 30 plus top, of course, from Alster. Can somebody give me the golden clue how to do this, quote-unquote? Side note, there is no strictly speaking golden clue. It's a combination of things. We'll get to that. But he continues, so far in my game, the AI or even my body have a tendency to get very big cities. I'm not sure what I mean by even my body.
Unfortunate implications.
Now, maybe English is not this person's first language, and as someone who can only speak English, you know, hey, you speak your language, first language, better than I do. You could have been posting in a rush. I don't know. I'm not sure what you mean. But I think you're saying is that the AI tends to get very big cities, and you do not. And how do you address that? There were a number of responses in the thread, and I think a lot of that can be broken down by city placement, buildings, social policy choices, wonders, including a national wonder, city states, and technologies. So why don't we actually start with city placement? So city placement, beside a river, if you can, near grave, so you can have grass, so hopefully you've got some grassland as well. Try to get yourself some wheat, bananas, and deer, and I'll tie that into a building eventually, or sheep, where you're getting plus one food. So if you actually see that resource, say, on a grassland, which gives you base plus two food, then you can get plus one food more if it has that particular resource. And if you're not near a river and you're by the coast, if you can find a coastal spot that has fish or even whales, then you can be getting plus one food with those as well. And if you find yourself in really crappy terrain, say surrounded by lots of desert or near desert, if you find an oasis, even though you can't improve it, that can also give you plus three food.
If your city's in the desert, like it's probably not getting to size 30.
Yeah.
Now, how about buildings? Let's see. Our granary might help. Get yourself pottery, plus two food, where you can also get plus one for wheat, bananas, and deer for some immediate growth. And if we tie it back into the river, you can get yourself a water mill for plus two food from the building itself, and then you also get plus one production too. If you happen to be the Aztecs, you can give yourself plus 15% food in that city too. As Imagine also noted in the chat, back to settling on ocean. You give yourself a lighthouse, you get plus one food from ocean tiles, and then plus one for each source of fish worked. Other buildings, just looking a little later on, you've got your aqueduct, where 40% of food is carried over after a new citizen is born, available in engineering. You've got a hospital, which if you build the aqueduct in the city and you get biology, now you've got plus five food. And then if the game is really progressing this far, and usually hospital, by the time you get hospitals, by the time most of my games have finished, if it hasn't finished by then. But anyway, there's also the medical lab, which if you have the hospital also, you can get plus 25% food is carried over after a new citizen is born. And that stacks with the aqueduct, which of course you would also already have to have.
Yeah, it's not really that complex in theory. You just plant a city somewhere that has a lot of food potential, like grasslands. And yeah, the river or lake and farm like crazy. And it's pretty much as simple as it is. Build the improvements that help your food and farm.
I don't think the question is so much, how do you get a city to size 30? It's more of a question is it worth it to take a city to size 30? Number one, because it takes a whole lot of time.
It's a very good question.
It takes a very long time to reach size 30. In a lot of games, the game will actually end before you can even reach that size. And then secondly, it's going to eat up a lot of happiness. Remember that happiness is global in Civ 5, so you're actually eating up a lot of your happiness by taking a city to size 30. Now, if you can get it there, it's probably worth it to do so, because large cities can be very valuable. It's more of an issue of just time. And then number two, the fact that you have to build all these city improvements. You have to build your granary, your aqueduct, and probably have to invest a lot of money in maritime city-states. The question is probably whether it's worth investing all that into building up the city than whether or not you have the happiness available. But in regards to one other thing in that post that I noticed when we were going over it, which is that why does the AI have so many large cities? That's because the AI gets a lot of benefits under the hood. I guess you could call it cheats if you wanted to. The AI basically always plays as though it's on Chieftain in terms of happiness, and it only deals with, I believe, 60% of the unhappiness that a human player gets. That's on all difficulty levels, and then it gets another happiness cheat per difficulty level. So on Deity, it's only getting, like, I think 30% of the unhappiness that a human player gets. So why are their cities so large? It's because the AI basically ignores happiness in Civ 5 and doesn't really have to deal with it. So it doesn't have to deal with the unhappiness issues that the human player does. So if you never had to deal with unhappiness, then yes, you'd probably have really large cities too.
Yeah, good to mention that about the AI, because I was kind of ignoring that part of the post. And it's also a good question about whether or not getting to a size 30 city is desirable. You said, yes, it can, but maybe we can even extrapolate the question more as how to get my city to grow, ? And specifically speaking of a size 30, I'm trying to even remember seeing a game go far enough where I saw an AI get size 30, like mid-20s certainly, but size 30? No, I can't. Nothing jumps out of my head as I recall for that.
I've done it in one city challenge type games.
Oh, well,
that's all you're going to do. I mean, what else are you going to do with your happiness? You're not expanding, so you grow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a lot deals with how many cities you're planting, too. If you're going to stick with two or three cities, your cities are going to be larger and you're going to have more happiness available. If you're going to go up to, say, six or seven cities, they're going to be using up more of your happiness and you're going to have less available to grow your cities vertically. So a lot deals with how you're planning on playing your Civ. And that also is going to depend on some of the in-game circumstances, how aggressive your neighbors are, whether you need to settle more cities to get more resources, that sort of thing.
This is an interesting dynamic, actually, because there's always a cost to growing. There's always something else you could be doing or somewhere else you could put that pop of your happiness. However, big cities, growing an additional pop in a city where you've already invested in the infrastructure, you're only paying the infrastructure for the multipliers in that city. There's something to be said for the strength of growing an additional pop in the city, especially if you have a good tile to work, for example. But at some point, the returns start to diminish there, and mm-hmm. you might want to be trying to put your investments into something else that will do more for your empire. And where you draw the line there is something that you either feel out from playing a lot, or you just straight calculate it based on your goals.
Yes, and indeed, along with city placement and even before, buildings also consider, you farm everything or indeed farm a lot, which you have nearby. Social policies, how about if you just choose one, and other than one social policy under another branch, with the tradition finisher now, I mean, need we say more? Plus two food and then plus 15% growth in each city. And before you even get to that finisher, grab yourself Landed Elite, which I think you can get as your second one, if you choose quote-unquote right on the first one, because Landed Elite gives you plus two food and then plus 10% growth in your capital. But I also know that under the Freedom branch available at Renaissance, there's a civil society where specialists consume only half the normal amount of food, but the biggest bang for your social policy buck will be tradition.
In terms of just pure growth, of course, the problem with that is that then you have to put, 6 points into tradition, which is a bit of a weak option overall. But if your only goal, if you're playing a variant or your only goal is to grow your cities as large as possible, then that would indeed give you a lot of growth, yes.
What would that be, like 80% carryover once you had all the tech and buildings and policies?
Well, you'd be limited by, let's just say you'd be limited by happiness, not by food.
Yes, definitely.
Wonders, I think you can actually talk about them in terms of direct and indirect benefit. And I mentioned Hanging Gardens first for a couple of reasons. One, Hanging Gardens is base game. You do not need any DLC for this. Available at Mathematics, plus 10 food in each, in the city itself. Woo, almost slipped there. But then the Temple of Artemis, which you get at one of the latest DLCs, which is, what's the name of it? The Ancient Wonders and something, something, something pack. Temple of Artemis at Archery, plus 10% growth in all cities. There's also a production boost for building ranged units, but since we're specifically talking about growth, plus 10% growth in all cities, never obsoletes, available so early, oh my. and indirect, kind of tying into the fact that what's going to probably limit your growth or the desirability of your growth is your happiness. I say indirect, I'm looking at wonders that have either they give you happiness, more happiness, or they help you combat unhappiness, like Notre Dame, plus 10 happiness, Forbidden Palace, not minus 10% unhappiness from citizens in unoccupied cities. You get plus 4 happiness from Chichen Itza and Taj Mahal. Eiffel Tower gives you plus 5 happiness, as well as plus 1 happiness for every 2 social policies you've adopted, not to mention the other benefits that they give you. And we've talked about the strength that is Notre Dame, especially along with the Porcelain Tower, Notre Dame, Forbidden Palace, and then, you know, Taj Mahal for Golden Age, and then Chichen Itza, which will extend the length of Golden Ages by 50%. It's all just starting to add up now. And then beyond that, if you get a Colosseum, also to happiness, I don't think it's as, I wouldn't say it's as necessarily as strong or desirable, but it's more about, are you actually going to be able to obtain this, which is easier in a smaller empire than a larger empire, because A, you need a Colosseum in all of your cities for this, and the more cities you have, the more expensive this is, which is the Circus Maximus National Wonder, which gives you plus 5 happiness, and as we know, happiness is global in Civ 5. I think there's a couple more ways, if you want to add to your arsenal, for strictly growth considerations. One is the Maritime City-States, not as desirable as it used to be. I believe, you need to at least be at friends, allied preferably if you really want to push the city-state thing. I'm trying to remember the exact numbers. I know the capital will give you a little more, and then the other cities. And then a little later on, technology, get yourself fertilizer, requiring chemistry, and it increases the food from farm tiles without fresh water, which of course gives you, is probably likely going to give you a massive boost to growth. Assuming, of course, you actually have farm tiles without fresh water, which is probably the case on a lot of maps and for a number of your cities. Did I miss anything else as far as pure growth goes? I don't think.
Nope.
Yeah, I kind of sunk my teeth into this topic for some reason. I like growth. There we go. I'm pro-growth.
Oh, man.
As much as you like abuse?
Let's just leave that at that.
Yeah, we'll combine the two. I'm pro-abusing growth. There we go.
I don't know if people want to be abusing that kind of growth. This thread started by the AKT with dots in between the AK and the KNT. And he says, I think that cavalry needs a buff because then lancers be more used. My list of buff needing units are lancer, cavalry, and ironclad. And that's pretty much the entirety of the opening post. Essentially, this thread is dedicated to units that we believe that need a buff, starting with the Korean turtle ship and moving on from there.
The problem with a lot of these units is not that the unit themselves is necessarily bad. It's that a lot of them come at awkward places on the tech tree. I know that the Lancer, I think, is one that springs to mind. And a lot of them also don't upgrade or don't have upgrade paths that are very good. Now, some of this may have been fixed since I was playing Civ 5 a lot. I'm not entirely sure what they've done with some of the upgrade paths. But I know that in the past, there were units that just came in really awkward places on the tree. The Ottoman unique units were a good example. Both units, good in and of themselves, but they weren't very useful because you couldn't upgrade anything to them, and they had a very short window before they were obsoleted by other units. So I'm not sure if that's still the case, but I know that that was the case in the past. So I'm afraid I can't speak too much on this issue because I'm not entirely familiar with everything that's changed in patches since I was playing a lot. But I know, like I said, for a lot of these units that they either didn't upgrade to something or nothing upgraded to them, and upgrades are very powerful in Civilization V because you can keep all your promotions when you upgrade, except for the case of when ranged units have ranged promotions and they upgrade into, you know, a rifleman or something. But other than that, you can keep all your upgrades. So one of the reasons why a lot of units were bad, at least in the past, is just due to the way that the tech tree and the upgrades were set up.
Actually, the Ottoman units were pretty good because you keep one of the best things about unique units, well, arguably, in Civ 5 is you keep their unique benefits when you upgrade them. So, for example, an upgraded Janissary would retain the ability to insta-heal upon killing a unit.
Well, and, right, but you could get the still... tech for with the Janissaries, you would. I mean, rifling was only two techs away, and so you would just instantly leap from muskets to riflemen, and you wouldn't even have a chance to build that many unless you were deliberately building units only for the purpose of upgrading them, which is kind of a really silly thing to do in terms of game design. But I there was that.
That was a gold-based game. You just buy all the Janissaries.
We never do silly things in this game.
It's all you'd hammer anything out.
I mean, it's a little silly to say that something's a good unique unit because you can upgrade it into something else and keep that same ability.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess that that's possible.
I totally have done that, though.
It seems silly. And, of course, Aztec Jaguars are another good
I think you can get there.
I've had, you know, mobilized infantry running around with, and to forget the name of the ability, that they were originally impies. They've been upgraded that much in Civ 4.
Wow, that's, that's quite a way to...
In general, if there's any
from hunting plus bonds working to robotics.
Yeah.
In general, though, just to get back to the original topic, if there are units that are probably underpowered right now in Civ 5, it's probably mounted units because they were super overpowered when the game came out, and then they were nerfed in response to that, and well needed too. It was a nerf that needed, but with the penalty that they have to attacking cities, it does kind of remove most of the role that they have in the game. You can still use them, but they're definitely less useful than a lot of other units right now. So if anything, it would be nice if there was some way that you could sort of get them back into the game and make them more useful, aside from the one situation of being able to finish off a unit and then move again afterwards. But other than that, they don't really have that great of a role in the game right now. You're generally better off with strong melee units and siege units and the other ranged units than building a whole lot of horsemen or knights at the moment.
Yeah. People have, I don't know if it was this third or someone else, but somebody said that mounted has been so strong over the in previous games, and it was so strong at release that they just over-nerfed it. And I agree, if there's one unit class that really needs a buff in general, it's mounted, because it's so, its usability is limited. You know, it's hard to attack 4 to 5 positions with it, and you really can't do anything to cities with it unless you are like big eras ahead, which I guess you can pull in Civ 5 through research agreement abuse, but I mean, assuming you're not doing that, they're kind of hard to use in a tech parity war, and that really takes away the importance of one of the two key strategic resources in the game, well, of the early game, and obviously oil and whatnot later. But yeah, between iron and horse, you know, a lot of people really hate when they don't get any iron because they're stuck with only horse. And
well,
yeah, that wasn't really true in the other games.
Sorry, I didn't want to talk over you there. But Civ 5 would really benefit from having another metal resource in the early game, so it's not just iron or nothing. I know that Civ 4 did this by having copper, and I'm not saying they necessarily had to do this, but it really is a case of if you don't have iron, you're in very bad shape. And that was the case in Civ 3 as well, so they kind of went back to that dynamic from the previous game. But in Civ 5, normally you're fighting combat in one of two situations. Either you're defending, which is usually in... you're either defending your own cities, in which case defensive bombardment, siege units, things like archers are very strong because you can attack the units as they sort of funnel in towards your cities, or you're attacking someone else's cities. And in neither of those situations are mounted units particularly effective right now between those two situations. So like we said, there's probably room for them to play some sort of role in the game, perhaps if they get some kind of flanking benefit just innate to their unit class, is in addition to things from social policies. But right now, there's not that great of a role for them in the game. Perhaps even just removing the city attack penalty would help them. But I don't know. Perhaps Firaxis will play around with that. You definitely don't see them too much. You see more units that are iron-based in the early game.
I'm hesitant to say that mounted units should lose their penalty against cities. Maybe that's mostly because of how overwhelming horsemen used to be upon release when they didn't have that penalty. I think that the mounted I think that mounted can use a buff, but I'm not going to go so far as to say I think that, okay, yes, their use is limited, but I think they really start to shine a little bit once you have knights. And part of the main reason I say that is because if they can move after attacking. I mean, yes, they don't have any defensive bonuses, but as long as you place it properly, especially if you realize, hey, there's a catapult or a trebuchet or a cannon of an enemy unit, I can move my knight in, take that out, pull it back, and then move in my my melee unit or my gunpowder unit or whatever it happens to be. I generally don't tend to build any any mounted units until knights. And yeah, seeing as how it and iron are the primary resources, I'm waiting until medieval till I think, okay, I've got these horses, that's nice. I would like to see a buff specifically to horsemen. And I don't know what that buff would be, but I am hesitant, especially with them, to take away their penalty against cities. I think in this thread, even a more interesting, I think you touched upon it already, Sula, when you talked about musket men, and that came up in this thread too. Montoff said that they need a 10% bonus against melee units, so it really is an improvement over the long swordsmen, but stay the same against the other types. You've got long swordsmen that come the era earlier. Yes, they require iron, but you could be using long swordsmen in this time to be getting them promotions, and you can still be building them when you can get musket men, and they have the same combat, they have the same movement, and they're cheaper. And I really, yeah, I mean, musket men, I'm just kind of like, oh, that's nice. My musket men, I usually end up with, you know, if I'm friends with the military city state and they gift me one, I go, oh, okay, that's nice. But to me, any units that I, generally speaking, think I'm probably not going to use in this game because of the way that they are, either in and of themselves, like horsemen, or in relation to something comparable, like musketmen versus longswordsmen. So I would like to see a buff to horsemen, a buff to musketmen, and have it specifically be a bonus. I like Montoff's suggestion against melee units, because that's the unit that I'm thinking that, no, I would actually rather build. And so most other people would probably think that way too. So if I can get to musketmen, and then I can get some kind of bonus against melee, maybe 10% isn't enough, but some kind of bonus against melee, that would be more inclined to build them.
Going back to mounted also carries the dubious penalty of being hard countered by something that's resourceless, whereas other units don't have anything like that, with the exception of mounted's successors. I would really like to see the flanking thing added for mounted, maybe back to its original levels, because they were actually double nerfed. They not only were they nerfed in strength and city attack, they were nerfed when Firaxis pulled the flat terrain penalty. They pulled the large bonuses from both discipline and flanking, because all you guys get a flanking bonus from, you know, you surrounding them and then attacking them, and when those bonuses were larger, combined with the strength of the horsemen at the time, it was ridiculous. You could one-shot, like, muskets and cannons with horsemen that you researched at the start of the game. But they took it too far the other direction. Long point short, I want to see mounted be at least dominant on the field again, and adding an extra flanking bonus to them might be what they need if you don't want to give them city attack back, which I could see you wouldn't. Because otherwise, knights are really only good when you have a lead.
Or if you want them to be open field units, you can increase their base strength and even increase the city capture penalty. Just make it so they're not good attacking cities, but they dominate in the open field. It's another direction you can go.
I mean, you can express, modifying a Civ's base strength depending upon the unit they're attacking is either you get a penalty against or you get a bonus against, and it could end up being, you know, six half dozen of the other, but... perhaps even beyond the musket men and long swordsman issue and a mounted in general. So I don't know if I have it in my notes here, but someone brought up the ironclad, which of course just made me laugh.
Was there ever a Civ game where the ironclad was good? Just out of curiosity.
I'm trying to even remember the ironclad before Civ 4. I'm sure it existed before Civ 4, at least I think it did, maybe in Civ 3, but...
It was somewhat useful in Civ 3, but it was still not a unit you saw very often, because naval units in general were pretty bad in Civ 3. There wasn't really much of a place for them.
Oh yeah, and back then the AI really didn't know how to do intercontinental war at all.
So yeah, ironclad still not entering deep ocean... The fact that it cannot melee attack, big deal. But not entering the deep ocean. I just keep on building caravels at that point and wait for destroyers, battleships, subs. The unit, not the food. Just
yeah. Frigates. Frigates.
Or for frigates. Yes, and frigates. We've talked about the poor ironclad before. the paratrooper actually contributed a fair bit to this discussion, more than I expected. I guess just because when we're talking about, you know, units beyond, well, okay, I'll go as far as industrial, don't really see a lot, and I guess I really don't have a lot of strong feelings on it because I often don't make it to that point in the game, and I'm not an advanced starts person that we've been to before. But the paratrooper, 40 combat, 2 movement, may paradrop up to 5 tiles away when starting in friendly territory, and some people feel that that needs a buff. Paratrooper can attack after dropping. It has 1 movement left, but can only pillage or move, so wouldn't be able to attack until the next turn. Oh, well...
But that was always true, though.
Yeah.
I don't necessarily agree that it should be able to attack after dropping.
Well, isn't that the only reason anyone would build a paratrooper in the first place?
Well, either that or you want to pillage a particular resource or a road to prevent, if people have a road, as a means to getting troops closer to the front.
Civ 5, with its flanking things and the 1 unit per tile rules, I don't know how far paratroopers drop, but if they can drop around people when they're attacking you, that could be potentially very annoying.
With as expensive as units are in Civ 5, that seems incredibly situational. I think a unit needs to be more useful than that if I'm going to waste the time building it.
Let's go crazy and let's forget about thinking about buffing this unit. Let's just get rid of it. We'll move on.
What's their main strength? Are they different from other units in the era? Because if they're not much different from other units in the era, I don't really see the downside. Other than like a bit more hammer cost or whatever. If I can't say one way or another, somebody says they need a buff in the thread, but they don't say why they need a buff.
Well, they like to use it in combination with bombers, as Magino noted in the chat. So, well...
I guess, just so you don't get destroyed by enemy cities, you bomb the crap out of the city and then you drop paradrop next to it and take it the following turn. I guess that's the theory.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of other units that come in modern era that give you some land-based combat, I mean, there's the mech infantry, which is combat 50 and move 3, and of course can't paradrop. I mean, three of the biggest advantage to paratrooper is that situational thing that you talked about there, Sula. The fact that they can paradrop, I mean, it's in their name, as opposed to saying, ooh, let's just make paradrop a promotion that, you know, you can get for almost any unit down the tree. Like, I wouldn't want to say, ooh, let's paradrop your tank.
Call in today. In North America, the number is 301-637-7659.
That's 301-637-POLY.
In Europe, 44-121-288-7659. That's 44-121-288-POLY.
You can Skype us at The Polycast or email us at thepolycast@gmail.com.
The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
For more information on Polycast,
our sibling shows Modcast and Revcast,
or about Polycast in general,
log on to the series' official website at thepolycast.net.
The Ustream backup doesn't record the ad, and certainly the recording that I'm making locally on my machine does not include that ad, but still kind of annoying for, I mean, not too many people listen to the show live, but I don't mind that there are ads. It's just, tell me. It's like the game. It's like, no, tell me what's going on.
Yeah, that's kind of weird. Just interrupt the show.
Like, it's mysterious.
I'm curious. Just Magic, can you tell us what the ad was for? You know, if it was to buy a game or something like that, that would be awesome. A car ad. Oh, okay. Don't drive away angry. Listen to the show some more. Yeah, I don't know. I tried.
Car ad on this podcast. This reminds me of when I got gardening as one of my tags in YouTube by the generator. I'm not sure how well Let's Play equals gardening, but yeah, the online algorithms are funny sometimes.
Like farming experience points or something.
Yeah, that's true. I might have said something about farming or irrigating. You're right. That didn't occur to me. We're also sponsored by the letter T.
Virtual.
Yes, exactly.
I was more attempting a Sesame Street reference, but that works too.
Yeah. I think we're also sponsored by the letter A.
Only in Canada.
What's this opening post by Dan Q? What?
And on those wonderful puns,
wonderful by some people's standards,
that takes us to the end of the show.
Thank you for joining us for episode 129 of Polycast. I am K-Mad, and I was joined by Dan Quick.
Nominate Polycast in the 2011 Podcast Awards at podcastawards.com.
Makalua.
You'll want to be nominating us for Best Produced and in Gaming.
And me and team.
My MPR tanks.
Yeah, you're crazy, dude. And our special guest, Sula.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for having me on the show. Thanks to everyone for listening.
I would just like to paraphrase someone that could perhaps summarize this show or any show that we talk about Civ. Few games make me want to punch a hole in my computer monitor. Civ has been one of them.
Record date September 17th, 2011. Civilization 4, 5, and World Sound Clips, copyright Take-Two Interactive. Copyright Civilized Communication at civcom.net.